Fangoria has been at it for over 40 years and is better than ever. This magazine, it's not only gorgeous, it's highly collectible and delivered right to your door 4 times a year. Each issue is filled to the brim with articles exploring every nook and cranny of genre filmmaking, past, present, and future, with all the most exciting journalists, filmmakers, and horror know-it-alls to guide the way, including little old me from time to time. This high-quality writing will only ever appear within the physical pages of the magazine, so if you want to join in on the fun, well, you're going to need to subscribe, and in order to do that, all you got to do is head on over to Fangoria.com and sign up. If you do, you can use the code KINGCAST at checkout to save a gigantic 25% off of your order. That is Fangoria.com, code KINGCAST. Now on with the show.
Hi. My name is Stephen King.
He's gonna break!
Bedroom! Bedroom!
You guys wanna go see a dead body?
Well, sometimes death is better.
Hello and welcome back to the KINGCAST on the Fangoria Podcast Network. My name is Eric Vespi.
I'm Anthony Bresnikan.
And we are your hosts. There's a nasty little movie coming out soon, and I say nasty in the most complimentary way that you can use that word. It's called Obsession, and it's the ultimate in be careful what you wish for horror. It's about a guy who's head over heels in love with a girl in his friend's group, and he wishes for her affection, and boy howdy does he get it. And you got to see all the chaos that unravels after that. Go see it. The second that it's available in a theater near you, you won't be disappointed. It has the KINGCAST seal of approval. And today we have two of the stars of Obsession joining us. We have Michael Johnston and Cooper Tomlinson. We're going to talk a little bit about the movie. We'll talk a little bit about their favorite King things. But gentlemen, welcome to the KINGCAST.
Thank you.
Happy to be here.
This is a monkey's paw story, essentially, like the classic story. You wish for something, you get your wish, but it comes with strings attached. And The Monkey's Paw was a big influence on Stephen King. It's a big influence on writers in general, since I think it came out in, what was it? Was it the late 1890s, Eric, when The Monkey's Paw was
published?
When
The Monkey's Paw hit? No, jeez. That's a little bit before my time, believe it or not.
Is that right?
Believe it or not.
But it's the origin of Pet Sematary. It's like quoted in Pet Sematary. So did you guys talk about The Monkey's Paw much in terms of Obsession and the One Wish Willow, which is the paw in this situation?
We didn't talk about
you?
It a
yeah,
ton.
No, we did
didn't
not.
Dive into the lore, really. It was more about the characters. It was a device, but we didn't spend a lot of time.
Yeah, I remember it being just like when Curry brought up the idea for the first time, he was like, it's a monkey paw, you know, and it was, you know, it's like that. But other than that, no, yeah, like Michael said, just the characters and the story.
Yeah, well, one thing that I love about the framing of it, and I think we can say this without diving into any spoilers here, but it's not like in stories like this, it's usually you walk into a creepy, like, did that store even exist yesterday? Is it run by, you know, Satan in disguise or whatever? It's usually that's where these kind of artifacts can be found. And here, essentially, this One Wish Willow thing is a novelty thing that you would find in any like mom and pop, like, you know, those toy stores that are like none of the kids ever want to go into because it's just like fucking wooden blocks and
yes,
you know, and like maybe some like close enough to Mickey Mouse or Donald Duck thing where it can be recognizable without being sued kind of thing. It's like any one of these things would just have like a little 30-cent tchotchke or whatever that
it's like the toy store you find at the beach or something.
Right.
In a resort town.
Yeah.
It's got nothing anybody wants in it.
And it advertises like, hey, you know, you can't take it once you make the wish, you can't take it back, you know, and one wish per customer or whatever. And you know, I love that it's not one of these like even like Big where the you know, the Zoltar machine, you know, disappears and it's mysterious what happens.
That
it's
movie.
Just like no, it's just like, you know, once your character realizes what, you know, Michael, what your character realizes that he's made a step or two in the wrong direction here, it's not hard to track these things down, right? And it's just like, yeah, I love there's a customer service call moment where, you know, where I just love that in the reality of this world, this is a thing that exists and it's out there and it can actually work, you know, and I don't know where I'm going with this other than I think that it's a very cool way to have this kind of element in a horror movie. And the way you guys, you know, play it, especially you, Michael, when just that frustrate, the average frustration of being on the phone with customer support, and then let alone when it's this life or death situation and they don't seem to give a shit, you know?
You know, we didn't have the time. I mean, if we were making a TV series, I would have loved to see after Cooper's character, Ian, I'm going to keep it vague for spoiler reasons, but you let us know if we cross over a threshold where we can start talking about spoilers, if we get to that, if it feels necessary. But like, I would have loved to see more scenes between Ian and Bear after Ian believes, oh, this thing is real, you know, but no, I mean, I just know that Curry's been saying that he really wanted it to be something that you could just walk into any store and buy versus it being like what you said, like a creepy dark crystal shop, because we've seen so much of that before. And this story just kind of jumps right in after Bear makes the wish, and we wanted it to just be like, yeah, that happened. It wasn't a creepy, not even necessarily. And this is an interesting conversation. I'm like, Curry, like, is the One Wish Willow haunted? Is it evil? And he's like, no, you just have to be careful how you word it. I'm like, oh, man, that's even more scary to me. Yeah.
You gotta read the fine print of your own contract. Yeah.
Because I would totally fuck that up. If I got one of those things, I would be the guy like, give me $1 million, and then a $1 million in cash would fall off of a plane and squish me. You know, I'd be that guy. I wouldn't think of all the various perfect ways to phrase things. You need to get a lawyer to get one of those One Wish Willows, yeah.
Well, I mean, it's the root of your comedy, right? You and Curry started out as a comedy group called That's a Bad Idea. Like, the bad idea is woven into the concept, right?
Yeah, you know, we're always trying to, you know, take a really relatable, real grounded idea and just flip it on its head. And, you know, like Michael was saying, I mean, this is a pretty simple premise. I think a lot of people can try to expect where it's going, but we always divert the expectation, and you know, it's very familiar, but how do we be different? That's something we're constantly asking ourselves. We were constantly, you know, discussing on set, and you know, I think we succeeded.
Yeah,
I'll say.
For sure.
Yeah.
but it's all rooted in character, as you were saying, because this, you know, this doesn't really have to me that moment that a lot of genre can have, that joke of like, you know, don't run up the stairs, run out the front door, the slasher tropes or whatever. You know, the characters react in a very real human way. And even what's happening to, you know, the poor lead of the movie, you know, to her, it's like once you start seeing the human impact of what's going on, and the monster is also sympathetic, but it's also not there. You know, there are so many layers to this thing. And it's something that I think could easily have been more schlocky with the premise that it has, but there, I think the reason why it's so effective and the reason why audiences are reacting to it the way that I've seen personally and the way I keep, you know, reading about online is because there is that actual human connection there. And I have to imagine that, you know, from both of your perspectives, you know, bringing those characters to life, that must have been a top priority to make this thing work. Yeah,
it's like Cooper and Curry's That's a Bad Idea comedy sketches are like all about what's not said, and they make you feel so you laugh because it's so uncomfortable and hilarious and bizarre. And one thing that I think translated really well is that they really don't try to tell you how to feel. You can have your own reaction to whatever's happening. And I think like what's so great about all of the friends and all the four like friend characters in Obsession, their relationships are so kind of nuanced. They're not like just best friends. They have a lot of secrets, and it's so interesting to watch. And like I love grounded, real performances, especially in horror, because I really want it to feel like, I hate the tropes, the we have to go back or let's split up. Like, that just takes me out of it so much. But I just think it was such a great mix of people, like I don't know, like Curry, Cooper, like you got the whole team, you know, bringing it together. We all brought something, a little flavor to this whole thing. And we were never talking about these like big moments. Okay, this is the part of the movie that has to be scary. This is the part of the movie that has to do this. It was always rooted in the characters and their perspectives. Everything. That is all we talked about.
Well, and you just let it unfold.
Let it go. And sometimes we don't know where it's going to go.
Right.
What would you say is the real world corollary? So many great horror stories. You know, they're a commentary on something we experience in real life. Well, we were talking about Pet Sematary, or I was talking about Pet Sematary and Stephen King, and it's this wish that you could have your child back after they're taken. And I think the fear of losing a child is a primal thing that almost anybody could relate to, whether you're a parent or not. But what is the core of this movie? Is it relationships, dating? When the peril of somebody in the relationship caring more for the person than they do? What would you say is sort of the real world fear that this movie obsession is exploiting or exploring?
Well, I have an idea, but if you want to go, Cooper.
I think the first thing off the top of my head is loneliness. I think you know, all the characters have secrets and everybody just feels completely alone. And, you know, Bear makes this wish because he wants to have a connection. And I think what he doesn't realize is, as you'll see, whoever hasn't seen the movie, is he had a community. He wasn't alone the whole time.
Right.
And that's the thing he misses out on, unfortunately. And so be careful what you wish for. But Michael.
No, absolutely. Like, you hit the nail on the head. Like, this, you know, I don't think this movie is actually about love or romance or relationships, and I just think it kind of uses that as a device, because really it is coming from loneliness, and it does speak to like this loneliness epidemic that I think is really driven by all of this. Mm-hmm. And I just think Bear,
he's holding up his phone, podcast listeners.
Oh yeah, sorry podcast listeners, I was texting. Yeah, no, but it really is, like, because and limerence too. So I guess that is more relational. Just the idea that somebody is going to come into your life and be the answer to all your problems. And we don't really dive into this a lot, but if you kind of pay attention, you'll notice right at the beginning of the movie specifically that Bear has just like lost a pet. He's just lost a grandmother, and his parents aren't really around. He's been through, he seems like a nice guy, but he is really lonely, and he's completely avoiding those feelings because he's just focused on this idea of this girl, so much so that I feel like he doesn't even really, he's been spending a lot of time around her, but like, he can't even feel comfortable enough to just tell her how he feels. Like, that's like kind of sad. I don't know.
It's a tragedy. Seems like he doesn't really need a relationship with her. He needs her to fill this void that is in himself, you know, which is never going
to
work out.
She gives him the opportunity to,
they could have maybe even been, maybe.
Yeah.
Like I'd love to see the version. That's my wish. I want to see the version where he tells her how he feels. Maybe she tells him the truth. I don't know. Who knows? Who knows which way it goes? You know?
I think without getting into spoilers, can we explore what the proper wording of this wish should have been to make it work out a little better? Should he have wished, I wish that she loves me as much as I love her? Should he have wished, I wish I'm someone who could make her fall for me? Like, what is the right way to thread that needle?
Because the wording on it now is, you might have to refresh my memory on this, but it's something like, I want her to love me more than anything else in this world.
The wording, the exact wording, so it's the trailer, they actually dubbed it to take out the cuss word. But I wish, is that okay to say here?
Sure,
curse
out. So I wish Nikki Freeman loved me more than anyone in the fucking world is the actual, it's very mumbled, but like that's what he said. And he's at this most vulnerable moment that he wishes that. Of course he... You know, a lot of people are giving him shit, and they say, and a lot of critics that are like being a little bit more critical about this movie are saying, it's all about this guy who just makes this girl his little whatever. And I'm like, but he did not ever know that this was going to happen. It was his own selfish desire. And then maybe later he kind of goes with, but like, he didn't know that that was going to happen. He was just like saying those things we say to our, it was almost as significant as a thought that you have in your head that no one else hears. And I think that's the whole thing, is the correct wording would have been to not make a wish at all and to just tell her how you feel, because I can't imagine how a wish would change anything.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it takes away her agency, right? That's the kind of the root of all this is,
right?
She's being forced to feel a certain way that she isn't, and to the point where she's not literally herself anymore. No, I mean, it seems to me like if you're upset about that, then you're upset at the little kid and liar, liar for wishing that his dad would, you know, would tell the truth.
Took away Jim Carrey's agency.
Why'd you take away Jim Carrey's agency? Exactly.
Yeah.
It's like, when you see the movie, I could see that being something that maybe if you've only seen the trailer that you might, I could see that criticism coming out of like, oh, just the whole basic premise of this. But like when you see the movie and the lengths that, you know, Curry and you guys like go to ground this and to, you know, to show that this isn't a good thing. There's no, you know, silver lining to this cloud, you know, and the malice that's there, again, it all comes from this what happens to a lot of us, where we get like stuck in this quicksand, like we're in a bad situation and we just struggle and it gets worse, which is honestly one of my favorite like sub genres of, especially in horror, this kind of whole, you know, walls closing in, everything, every choice you make is just compounds everything and makes it worse. Like, I don't know what it says about me, why I'm the sicko that like gets enjoyment out of those kind of movies, but like the darker and more fucked up it goes, Dick, like the happier I am. So as I said, Obsession has the King Cast seal of approval, at least, you know, yeah, at least from my perspective. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, just that being said, you know, there's so much that this movie also has to say from like the female perspective as well, when it comes to agency and everything. And I feel like, you know, I would rather let Indy and Megan speak to those topics. There are so many things that are touched upon, but what I love about this movie is it doesn't tell you how to feel. It just presents these ideas. And so, you know.
So since we're the King Cast, we like to ask our guests what their Stephen King origin story is. So for both of you, when did you first become aware of Uncle Steve and all of his evil works?
Should I start, Michael?
Please do.
Start with Cooper.
I think when you're a kid, you're always going through the library and you see this big lettering Stephen King, or you see King and you're like, what is that? These look interesting. You know, you see the It. You know, so I'd see those books, but I feel like my origin story is obviously, you know, with a movie. And I think there's like a couple different origin stories. Like my original is The Shining, you know, and you're like, so this guy is the horror guy. Oh my gosh. I saw The Shining in my buddy had a theater in his house. And every literally no joke, like every day after school, we'd run over to his house. This is how I really like saw the movies I shouldn't have. And his mom had the fridge stocked with the, you know, the Sprite, and had the candy stocked up. And I might've gained a few pounds as, you know, when I was in, you know, middle school. And we go in there and we'd watch. I remember one of the first ones we watched was The Shining. And that was just like a trip, you know, like a different kind of horror movie. And it, kind of like Obsession is. It's not like in your face jump scare, you know, like the horror formula. It's so different and unsettling. Mm-hmm. You know, this it also follows this guy who's dealing with loneliness, you know, and like trapped in this, you know, never ending hotel, you know, for the winter. So that was it's a groundbreaking movie, but you know, like I didn't know how to feel about it at such a young age, but rewatching it really like it holds up. It's really truly one of the best. I would love to spend the night in that hotel.
I would too.
I think that'd be a fun, I don't know, bring the camera, have a night in the hotel. You know,
spend the night in like multiple hotels to get that experience, because the interior looks like one hotel that's off. It's like in Big Bear or something, right, Brez?
It's in Yosemite.
It's in a park where you like, but if you look at walkthrough videos of people like, here's the lobby. It's like Kubrick literally just told his production designer, make that in our London soundstage.
It's wild.
The exterior is the Timberline up in Washington. Oregon? Yeah, one of those two. Yeah.
But yeah, if you go to Yosemite, go to the Awani Hotel, walking through, it looks like the set. Like, it looks so much like it, right down to the red elevator doors, the check-in nice. Area. You really start, okay. It starts to get under your skin. If you want to stay at the Shining Hotel from the movie, that's the place to go. It's right. really bizarre. The room where he does the writing is there, like, and it also has like gosh. in the mid-40s, I guess, during World War II, it became a convalescent hospital for sailors. Like, they would bring like busloads of wounded sailors in to recover there. So there are all these like pictures of black and white pictures of people in like hospital beds lying in the in the big lobby where you're sitting, and like, it's super unsettling.
Why does the ocean make things so creepy? I've always been extra creeped out by anything on a ship. Well, because you're stranded. You're out on the ocean. But any kind of like vastness haunted of sailor. Do you guys, this is a little, do you guys know the scary stories tell in the dark books?
Yeah, man, yeah, those of things, course, yeah.
The illustrations.
The black and white illustrations. And yeah.
Dude. Yeah. Sorry, I know it's random. It reminded me of that.
Yeah, for sure.
Traumatized a generation of elementary school kids.
those were the books at the Scholastic Book Fair that you could get. They wouldn't put Stephen King out for me, and I was reading Stephen King in elementary school because I'm a weirdo. But Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark was there, and I'm like, and those are so much worse because they have those great illustrations,
it's just
you
a
know,
picture, man.
And
yeah.
the stories of like the girl with the pimple, and it turns out the spider laid eggs in her face, and all the spider babies come out of it. That's so much worse than The Mist. I mean, come on now, for a 10-year-old? Yeah.
Yeah, get your imagination going.
So, Michael, what's your Stephen King origin story?
Stand By Me.
Great one.
So, I remember I was 12, I think, and I think like that's the age that they are in the movie, mm-hmm. right, most of them. And I remember my extremely religious Aunt Kathy. Everybody has an Aunt Kathy, right, Cooper?
yeah.
And she, you know, she was so strict, but I remember she came in this day and she's like, I had a conversation with your Uncle Terry. We're going to let you watch this movie. It has a dead body in it, but we think it's an important movie. We're going to let you watch it. And man, that movie just, I watched it over and over and over and over, specifically to pause at the part with the dead body. But I just became, and then, you know, I have, like you said, Cooper, I have a handful of different origin stories because
yeah.
I remember watching, where is it? Oh my God. Well, I love Misery. Oh man.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. So I love
this Shawshank Redemption. I don't know what came first.
You're knocking
I think,
out all the Rob Reiner associated.
I know, right?
What a filmography.
I love that one. I love that one. Speaking of being trapped in tiny little spaces and being kind of a screw up and being lonely, man, you know.
Well, yeah. And you know, a funny thing about that one that I only discovered doing the show was before the Andy Muschietti It movie, 1408 was the biggest, highest grossing Stephen King movie. It opened huge. You would think it'd be Misery. Maybe if you like look at Stand By Me or some. The Shining was a failure when it came out. So that one I wasn't.
So that's so crazy.
That's insane.
I fucking hated it. And not just like critics, like horror genre fans. Go back and like look at, dig up old Fango issues or Cine Fantastique or any of these geek magazines when that came out. All the letters to the editor, they're like, I just saw The Shining and it ruined the book. And how did Kubrick, you know, it was nominated for Razzies. People like hated,
really?
Hated
wow.
the movie. Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. It got zero Academy Award nominations, but it got a handful of Razzie nominations.
Yeah.
But it lives on. It lives on.
Yeah. And it's, you know, it's a crazy thing to think about, like the impact and how things change and what lives with, you know, within you. And there's something about the way Kubrick handles The Shining that's so immersive, and it like it can't help but stick with you. And I have to imagine a lot of these people, a lot of folks probably jumped on the bandwagon. There were probably a lot of people who, you know, just knew the book first and knew the story first and missed a feeling they got from reading it, and I get that, but like I don't know.
One
like
of them
even
was Stephen King, who didn't
viewings,
like the movie.
Well, for sure, you know, yeah. It's like, you know, that's
he didn't like the movie.
He didn't, very famously, yeah.
Wow. Still doesn't, but he's coming around a little bit. But
And it's funny because I've done a lot of studying on this era and seen a lot of his speeches and his college lectures and stuff he would do that were recorded for posterity that you can go find on YouTube. And you can see a progression there where he's talking about before it came out. He's just like, you know, oh, you know, it was a mostly positive experience. He was always very critical of Jack Nicholson in the lead, thinking that he was miscast. And after it came out, like, he got pretty vicious towards like Shelley Duvall and her performance. And he was very vocal about it. But you could see a progression of him going like, oh, Kubrick had a hill to climb to do it, to like, yeah, fuck that guy and fuck this movie. You know, and I think a lot of it had to do with just the fact every time he'd go out to a book signing or do one of these public appearances, he would hear, you'd see the questions that the audience are asking him back in the, like, 1980, 81, 82. And it's all like, how terrible is that Shining movie? And
that's crazy.
The movie kind of colors people's impression of the book. Even Caroline Bix, who's a lit professor, who just wrote a book about called Monster in the Archives about his archive, was saying in the book that when she met Stephen King and his wife, she was talking about the twins, how scary the twins are in The Shining. And he's like, yeah, they aren't twins in my book. That's from the movie.
Yeah. Grady has two daughters, but they're like multiple years apart. And the whole twins thing was a Kubrick edition. Yeah.
Oops.
Now, what about Coop? Because Cooper and I were just chatting a little bit. What about 2017 It?
Yeah, the Muschietti It.
Is that we just met him last night at the Obsession. Yes.
He's so cool. Him and Barbara are great. Yeah.
I told him that he looked like someone from Game of Thrones in the Night's Watch. Like, that's the first thing that came to mind. He was like,
he is, because he's so tall and he's got that.
I know.
Beard.
Yeah.
I love it. Mm. You know, it's like that movie, you got, it's like Stand By Me meets, you know, The Shining, the horror of The Shining.
Yeah, right.
Whatever, are we speaking, you know, of the original movie, which, like, or just the whole,
I'm all talking the 2017. The original is great with Tim Curry, yeah. but like, for me, like, I don't know, I was at that age when it came out, like, I don't know, I really, like, it was really perfectly done. And like the comedy goes hand in hand. Like, there's a lot of honesty with these kids. Like, me and Curry watched that. Whenever we're doing horror comedy, like, you know, when we were writing anything but ghosts, like, we'd watch it because it's like, I don't know, it's just perfect. These kids don't split up, you know, like, as Michael was saying earlier, they don't just go into the sewer that, you know, because, okay, this is the part in the movie where they go in the sewer. It's because they have to, right, and they question things, and they, you know, like, it's really honest in the end, and the reactions and the horror, like, it's so funny, but it's so scary. It's like one of my favorite horror movies, perfectly done.
Yeah, it's,
what do you like about it, Michael? Yeah.
Well, go ahead, Eric.
No. I was just saying it's basically what we were talking about earlier. It's character first. Like, in, you know, the thing that works in Stand By Me is the same thing that works with it. Is like, I recognize not only myself in these characters, I recognize people in my friend group, my childhood friend group, that like maybe was a little bit more like Teddy or Vern or Chris or Richie or Bev. You know, it's like I could actually, thinking about it, I can see Ben Hanscom using the One Wish Willow on Bev, and ooh, that would have been a whole different
whole
different movie, I think. Go ahead, Michael.
I would just say that, I mean, you know, I saw the original It with Tim Curry first. And, you know, if I'm remembering, there's like a piece of dust floating. Sorry. Podcast, you don't see the dust. If I'm remembering correctly, like, the original It was like a long movie, right? It was like long.
Yeah.
It was a two-parter miniseries. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
What stuck in my mind was just Tim Curry's performance, specifically his voice.
Yeah.
Like, that thing, that haunted my dreams. I used to like go, hiya, Georgie. Don't you want the balloon?
Don't you want it?
You know what else is great about
fat boy?
Yeah.
What's great about the original and the 2017 is, like, it's not afraid to go to that place and, like, kill it. Like, it doesn't like pull its punches. Right. Like he killed Georgie in the first scene brutally. Actually, like
in the remake, man, it's brutal. Yeah. His arm is gone.
His like, arm's off.
Yeah.
When the teeth open up, you're just like, oh, shit.
Yep.
What I don't know. That, I love the 2017 It too. I love the most hilarious and scary scene. I can't remember what's the character's name. I'm forgetting with the pills and everything. And he's
Eddie.
Eddie drops the pills, and then that freaking zombie thing pops up. I mean, it's so funny.
Yeah.
And absolutely terrifying. And I also love how that movie just jumps from character to character, and it's like scary scene, scary scene, scary scene, scary scene, and it just doesn't. It just like hacks away, and I think it's such a, that movie is such a roller coaster. There's so many incredibly grounded performances. Those kids are absolutely fantastic.
They work so great together, and they gel so much as a friend group. You know, they're authentic. You believe it. But then, like the lottery of that movie, the lottery ticket that the scratcher, the $1 million scratcher winner they got there with was Bill Skarsgård. I mean, that's
absolutely.
You know, you jump into that, and I think you see that with It Welcome to Derry as well. It's like once he pops up into that show, it takes it from like a B minus or a C to like an A, like just because there's something about how he is so. He finds Pennywise so delicious. I don't know why that's the word.
That's the perfect way to describe it.
But he loves it, and he loves.
Yeah,
I got to visit the set of the first one, and I was there for they were shooting like B unit, you know, or second unit in one area. They were shooting like coverage of the Bev bathroom thing. So like it was all the bloody bathroom, and
that's one of my favorite scenes from that movie too.
Yeah, it was all on her dad, like. Coming in and over the shoulder of her stunt double or stand in or whatever. And, you know, in that red room. And then on the other thing, they were shooting the scene when it was the visual effects element of Pennywise popping out of the slideshow frame.
Yep. Yep.
So he was like him in a green box doing his thing
that
there.
Scene and then is haunting.
And I remember going, oh my God, this is so crazy. And then he like Bill like finishes, you know, they're setting up another shot or another angle or whatever. And Bill walks by and he just kind of looks at me, and he's got the Pennywise contact still in. The only part of him that's human is he took his glove off because he was going to go out and have a cigarette. So he had a human hand. And everything else was head to toe Pennywise, contacts, everything. And he looks at me and he just goes, hey, and he walks on by. And so that is my Bill Skarsgård story. He ended up coming on the show. I guess it was at the end of 2000. It was for Nosferatu.
It was for Nosferatu.
Him and
nice.
It's funny how cigarette smoking links the two Pennywises. Because whenever you see photographs of Tim Curry as Pennywise, he's always like... He's always like puffing on a Marlboro that's like half ash.
Yeah, there's
somebody
like
holding an umbrella over him, you know, to keep Toronto red from gas and smoke.
Of smoking Tim Curry, and then we had the about half of the cast of the original of the kids cast of the original miniseries have been on the show, and they came on and they were talking about how their like sense memory of Tim Curry is the smell of cigarette smoke.
Yeah. Pennywise is near.
Everybody get excited, it's Lumi Gummies time. Consistent, mellow, and super delicious, Lumi Gummies are specifically designed to make you feel good, not stoned. Whether you're looking for an end-of-the-day de-stressor, a midday mood boost, or, like me, help getting the best sleep ever, Lumi Gummies has a strain that's right for you. These gummies come in sativa, indica, and hybrid style, so however you like to take the edge off or get a relaxed, creative boost, they have the option for you. And they all taste good, which isn't something you can always guarantee with edibles. Now, I know they're a longtime sponsor of the show, but I am legit a big fan of Lumi Gummies. I've spent my own hard-earned money on them. I take them regularly. I specifically like their sativa and hybrid concoctions, which for whatever reason, those are the ones that really help me relax at the end of the day and keep me from pulling constant all-nighters as I'm wont to do. I don't know why my dumb body likes to have me stay up till the crack of dawn, but it's been that way ever since I was a kid, and these gummies help me keep on at least a semi-normal sleep schedule. Lumi Gummies are available nationwide. Go to lumigummies.com, that's lumigummies.com, and use the code KINGCAST for 30% off of your order. Again, that's Lumi, L-U-M-I, gummies.com, code KingCast. LumiGummies.com, code KingCast. All right, now let's get back to the show.
So many fantastic characters. I mean, from just Stephen King's books to see all the different interpretations and all the flavors that come out of it. I just like, I cannot comprehend how someone can be so, like, someone can be such a well of ideas. I mean, even like, another one, like the Long Walk, is that right? The Long Walk.
Yeah,
that movie, like, God.
That's very close to his book. And that's The Long Walk.
It's
a very interesting one because that is angry Stephen King. You know, he wrote that when he was in college. It you know, that it was released as a Bachman book, and most of the stuff he released under the pen name Richard Bachman are darker, more fucked up stories. The Running Man, not the Schwarzenegger version. You know, they're all very dark, mean stories. And and a lot of it's because he wrote, especially The Long Walk, he wrote, you know, during the height of Vietnam. He was in college and, you know, he had friends that were getting drafted. He narrowly avoided the draft. And
That's right.
Yeah. And so it was, he was in a little radicalized. He went into college as a young Republican. And after the first year, he was a protesting long-haired hippie. You know, it's like, you know, he was an angry guy when he wrote that. And if you read a lot of King, you'll notice that he's very much a humanist, and he believes the best in humanity for the most part. But then you get those occasional very angry fuck you stories, and that's like The Long Walk is one of the best. And I adore the adaptation. It made my wife fucking sob.
That's so good.
By the end of it.
Did he write The Long Walk and The Running Man like in the same, I don't know, era or time
Not
frame?
Not really. The Long Walk was written when he was like a college sophomore. And then The Running Man was written after he had graduated and was, I think either he was trying to find work as a teacher or had just started work as a teacher, but he was working at a gas station around that time.
My God.
His wife was working at the Dunkin' Donuts.
Both were written before he got famous, for sure.
Yeah, but, The Running Man was written before Carrie, but it was written in like a 1 week span when he was snowed in his trailer. So he, you know, I think he was going crazy with boredom and just dashed that off. But also he had like two little kids and no job and they needed ear medicine. And that book is about specifically that thing. The guy goes into this contest because his kid needs medicine. And, you know, I think anger and horror are very closely linked, but so is anger and comedy. Would you agree? Yeah. Is that maybe why guys like you, Cooper and Curry, like Jordan Peele, Zach Kreger, these people, you guys who are like very prominent voices in horror right now are all coming from comedy.
Yeah. Sorry, the question, I missed the top half of that.
Well, question is about the relationship between anger and horror, but also anger and comedy. And I'm pivoting that to talk about comedy and horror. And
I think they just, connecting, they go hand in hand. We're like, it's just all about being honest, you know, we love it, you know, because of these characters, we see ourselves in them. And like I was saying, just the reaction, the honesty, Michael in Obsession. I mean, like some crazy shit's happening to him, but it's really funny. You know, it's really just like, oh my, like the reactions in a theater, which is why you got to go see Obsession in a theater. You know, like, you know, you can feel however you want to feel. I don't know. That's what's great between horror and comedy is just the reaction,
it's a communal,
experience
for sure. Yeah. It's a big, and we're not just saying this for Cooper and Michael's back end points. Your experience will definitely be enhanced by going to see this with the crowd. It's just one of those movies. I was lucky enough. There's another Stephen King movie that jumped to mind here. I was lucky enough to see Mike Flanagan's Gerald's Game, which was a Netflix movie.
No, Eric, I was on the tip. Look, you don't believe me. I know podcasters can't see.
He was going to bring it up next.
Because that is that's probably the most rewatched adaptation I've ever seen.
Oh, really?
Like, I'm obsessed with that movie. I'm obsessed with it.
I was lucky enough to see it on the big screen because Flanagan showed it at Fantastic Fest with an audience, right? And that's an experience that most people don't get. And when you're in that, you know, when you're watching on Netflix, you can look away and like just la 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 to yourself whenever the degloving happens, right? but when you're in a theater and there's 200 people squirming at the same time. It heightens the experience. That's why a lot of us, you know, movie nerds are always harping on the theatrical experience, despite how shitty the local Regal might be with the allowing talking and not clean theaters and 80 minutes of ads before your AMC movie. Like there's all these negatives to it. But at the end of the day, to me, why I fell in love with movies was that communal experience. So,
yeah. Michael, it'd be so interesting to see a scene in Obsession where what happens to her in Gerald's Game happens to Bear.
Oh,
I would love to see how Bear gets out of that, if he ever does.
Yeah, I mean, I think the reason why I love that movie so much is because so many Stephen King stories are mean-spirited, or there is a lot of meanness that is explored in the stories. But the thing about that movie is everything is happening in her head, and you know, the biggest antagonist there is the fact that she's stuck, and maybe at some point the dog, the wolf, whatever it is, but you know, like there's no monster, right? The monster's her past. It's so human, like we were saying before. And it's also just so masterfully done, from the way that it's shot to the way that it's directed, the way that it's acted. I think that's why I am so obsessed with that movie. I kid you not, I've seen it. I've seen it five
it's a good
times.
One.
I just love it. And I still have not looked at the degloving. I still have not looked at it.
Haven't seen it?
I've looked away every time. Every time.
And that's one like that was long said to be unadaptable, that you couldn't make it.
I heard that. Well, he did it, though. He did it.
That motherfucker, he takes it as a personal challenge, I think. Because it's not like, you know, he's trying to do Dark Tower now. You know, he's got, you know what I mean? It's like all these things that everybody, following up The Shining with Dr. Sleep, nobody said that that could work. And that movie rules. And then... you had Life of Chuck, which when you read Life of Chuck, you go, there's no way that this would be this work as a movie. And it's one of the most beautiful movies that came out last year. You know, there's something about Flanagan taking on these unadaptable things that
Focusing on the character. He's focusing on what the characters are going through. That's the most important thing. Yeah.
Cause like you said, in Gerald's Game, it's not, you know, in the book, she's not really seeing herself or apparitions I think maybe she does visualize her dead husband talking to her. Am I right on that one?
Yes.
Yeah.
She sees the moonlight guy, but she then convinces herself that he's an apparition. And that's the twist at the end, is that he wasn't.
He was actually after all these things that she's kind of visualizing, but like, it's not written that way where she's literally talking to herself. In the book, in Flanagan, was like, this is a way to show, because in the book it's all in her head. You don't need to have a visualization in the book. It's just you can hear Jesse's own thoughts inside, right? And that was kind of the genius of that adaptation. Is he brought that into reality and gave you something that's visually interesting when you're trapped in the same room for 80% of your movie, right? So.
Yeah. Could just like talk about these things for like never ending. I am obsessed.
And it's great. And I think that we can like point at a lot of the process here, which is interesting because, you know, I'm not sure if you're aware, but King doesn't, he doesn't like outline. He doesn't like do the big board where all the beats are hit. He's not that kind of writer. He is a sit down and the fingers fly and whatever comes out writer, which, you know, sometimes leads to the reputation, I guess, of him not like nailing some of his endings. It's not a criticism I particularly agree with. There are examples where you can tell he painted himself into a corner. The Stand's a big one where it's just like, fuck, how do I get out of this now? Okay, the literal hand of God comes out of the clouds and explodes a nuke. You know, there are a couple of times where he gets caught doing that, but the reason why I think a lot of his stuff feels so grounded is because he writes in that way and he lets the characters and the moment dictate what happens next, and he's not working towards something and trying to shove a square brick through a round hole, right? Because he's already
Curry does the same thing. He did the same thing with Obsession. There's this guy and he likes his coworker. He finds this thing, but then this happens. And I mean, you'll see, like, it's like, where's this going next? You know, he lets the story unfold. And that's why it just, you know, blossomed into such a beautiful story. Cause it's just like, where's this character going next? And how's he going to get out of this? And he loves to write. And I think Stephen King does a really great job of too, loves to write characters in corners.
Right.
Vince Gilligan does. We do that. And, yeah. And how do we get them out of this? Got to be smarter than the audience. And the audience is smart.
How does that work with you, Cooper, when you're like, because you co-write things with him, right? So how does that, do you both write that way, or is it?
Yeah, we do.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like when we're writing a sketch, I don't know, we'll start one thing. We might have the whole idea for a sketch, but then it's like, what if this happened at the end? And I think our best work comes from just like, not being constrained to just this one thing, or like this has to be this, you know, right. Like let it go anywhere and let's just see where the best thing will come out of it, you know, the things you don't expect. And, you know, we'll talk about that another time on Anything But Ghosts, but yeah, you know, it's, we let it go, but we, you know, we're constantly thinking, questioning,
right,
you know, every move a character makes, you know, to make sure it doesn't feel slapsticky or cheesy or dishonest.
Right.
I'm so excited for Anything But Ghosts. Like, I don't really know anything. But you know, I mean, what a great, just, you know, you start with this really grounded horror through and through. But I think it's just like, I think it's so brilliant that you guys are, it's like horror again, but you're bringing your literal duo, your chemistry together into these characters. I cannot wait.
Did you guys shoot it already, or is it?
We shot it already.
Oh, mm-hmm. Exciting. Yeah. I only know a little bit. I read a little bit. There's a little Stephen King DNA in there too, because at least based on the log line, because isn't it about like these fake paranormal investigators that actually find real ghost shit?
Is
that
encounter a real ghost?
I mean, we talked about 1408 earlier. Like, that's this guy who like goes and visits, you know, these haunted places, you know, looking for proof of the afterlife and not finding it. But he over the years has become jaded and doesn't believe in any of this bullshit, and it just sells books. And then he finds what happens when he is actually shown a real haunted room. You know, there's something that's really juicy in that premise. So
it's fun. Yeah. And we watched it a lot, it chapter one, a lot in writing that script. So just cause, you know, cause the horror and the comedy, it's
the dynamic.
Yeah. Perfectly done. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, for sure. No, it's, I'm excited for that. You know, I mean, obviously, you know, Curry is like just fucking skyrocketing off of all this stuff. He's got that chainsaw thing that everybody's like, I see a new headline about that every day, I guess. You know, but it is really interesting, especially, you know, finding, cause if you go back and watch that original Tobe Hooper movie, you know, it is that grounding of reality, you know, this thing that's just so out there and crazy, which is, you know, something that I think people are excited about it specifically because of, if they've seen Obsession, they know that like there's a really interesting, dark, you know, grounded but fun element to it. And it's like so many people have gotten the chainsaw formula wrong. Tobe Hooper himself like couldn't sustain that, you know, and he went full on ridiculous comedy for the second movie, which I love, by the way, but it's you know, but there is something about that, and I think that it's really interesting, especially once everybody, you know, listening goes and sees Obsession, that, you know, that's the next project on the horizon for that dude.
Curry has such a flavor that is so clear, and I just think that flavor brought into something like the Texas Chainsaw Massacre is brilliant. I mean, I when I saw that headline, I didn't know anything about it until I saw it. I was like, this is brilliant. It's like a puzzle piece. It fits. I know it's going to be, I am so excited. I'm going to be bothering him. Like, oh man.
You text him saying, do you need a chainsaw victim? You need a chainsaw victim?
Oh no, I want to be the villain.
Be like getting squished by Godzilla, you know?
Yeah.
Getting eaten by a shark on screen and getting killed by Leatherface, yeah.
He's the right guy to do it, because it's like, that movie was an indie, like, made for no money. Yeah. And so, you know, coming from just making movies for no money, milk and cereal for $800, like, I think he's going to bring that DNA to this, so that'll be cool. I don't know much about it, you know?
Now tell me everything. We need some headlines out of this. Let's get some eyeballs on this. Tell me the biggest secret, the one that will ruin the friendship and the professional collaboration.
That's what we like to do here, ruin friendships.
It's a King Cast guarantee, baby. Yeah.
Yeah.
Great, guys. Was there anything else that you want to talk about when it comes to Mr. King or even your obsession? Is there one more plug you want to make, or do you have one more title that you want to chat about before we wrap things up?
I love 11/22/63. It is my favorite miniseries ever made. I just rewatched it. I watched like half of it, and then I ended up traveling, but
we were just talking about this because it came back because it's on Netflix.
It came back and it's having a resurgence.
I've never seen it. I can't wait. I'm going to go watch it immediately.
Michael, it's on Netflix.
I'm going to go watch it immediately. I know nothing.
It's about a guy. James Franco plays him, and there's a time machine, or basically you can, in the back of a restaurant. There's a portal that goes back to 1960. And he can go back in time, and it doesn't matter how long he stays in there, but like whether it's 2 minutes or 2 years, but when he comes back in, it's only been 2 minutes. And he sets out to save JFK in 1963. Oh, so it's, dude,
oh,
you know what's funny? You'd be really good as that character, Jake Epping, too, Michael.
That James Franco plays? I love every character that James Franco plays. I'm like, I want to take a crack at that. I love his greasy hair.
I keep meaning to check. There's that scene where he's watching TV and he's boarding because he has to go back and live for 2 years before JFK. Yeah. He can't stop the assassination until it happens. He has to live there.
That point. He has to
I can't wait to see this.
He has to make money. He has to gamble his way because he knows all the game, you know, the sports games, and he can make bets to make money.
Oh shit!
But he has to get a job. He has to survive. I mean, what? Like, it's such an interesting like series. It literally was like the first miniseries, right? You know, on Hulu. Like, I'm pretty sure it was the first.
I think it was the first Hulu one. Yeah.
Original, like, first,
yeah,
like,
J.J. Abrams produced it, and yeah.
Yeah, J.J. Abrams. I can't wait to see. Gosh.
I think this is from the book. Eric, you correct me if I'm wrong, but, like, they're watching TV, and he's boarding with this older couple, and the guy's like, so you were in the service? And he's like, yeah. He's like, you know, what division? He goes, MASH, 4077. Yeah. And the guy's like, right on.
Yeah. Just using his pop culture knowledge to get him out
exactly.
Of
like, that's how I would get through the past with my vast knowledge of movies and TV shows.
I mean, and 11/22/63 is a very interesting book for King, too, because he was in a little bit of a writing funk from when he got hit by the van in the late 90s. And a lot of his books, you can tell that's like Dreamcatcher. You get some of his weaker output in this period of time where he's finding his voice again, and he finishes the Dark Tower series, and then he jumps in 11/22/63, and so that book to me marks like the second golden age of King. Like, that's, then he just is banger after banger after that. There's a great book that you guys, I'd highly recommend, that he wrote around this time called Joyland that nobody has read really.
I've never heard of it.
Yeah,
that's a hard case crime book.
Yeah, it's about a college student working a summer at like one of these beachfront pier amusement park things in the northeast, and their haunted mansion there is legitimately haunted. There's a ghost in there.
And, was it ever made into a film or show?
Nope. It's been optioned a bunch of times. Nobody's ever made it. I think that's you talk a lot about like a Stand By Me kind of King, and this to me is one of the unadapted King stories that could live in that echelon of quality. You know, it's a very great coming of age story that just happens to have a ghost in it. So
nice.
So yeah, no, but yeah, 11/22/63. Highly recommend it. He does a thing. I mean, just the main fact that you know that this isn't like a time portal that takes you right to the moment you need to be in. It's very inconvenient. If he fucks something up after waiting 2 years, he's going to come back and have to start over again from the, you know, from the, I think it's the late '50s in the book, right?
It's like the old school Nintendo games that if you die, you had to go all the way back to the beginning.
So he has to go start from the same point every time he goes back into the portal.
So literally he steps through a portal and it's the exact same moment on the exact same day. And so he's limited. Wait. And you also find that time does not want to be changed. Like history does not want to be changed, and things start working against him. The closer to changing a small thing is difficult. It changing a big thing, like trying to stop the assassination of a president, is an even bigger thing. And anything that can go wrong will go wrong. And it's so that feeling I told you about that I was a weirdo for loving, you know, that's in Obsession, and it's also in here where it's the walls close in and things just keep going wrong, and everything you do to correct it just make three more problems. You know, there's something about that kind of storytelling that just really engrosses me, and that's definitely prevalent in that story.
I feel so inspired. I feel like I want to go write. I have like an idea. I'm like, oh man, I need to, just everything going wrong, just more and more. What can possibly go? Well, I have one little thing I would love to plug right now that I took a little look at my phone. And while we were on the phone, Cooper, I don't know if you know this, but we are officially certified fresh.
Ooh.
Rotten Tomatoes.
Breaking news. That's awesome.
Gonna get that plaque, display it proudly.
Hell yeah.
That is so cool.
Which, you know, again, that goes to show like how the character work, you know, is connecting to people. Because, this is a story, sometimes audiences can turn against horror stories that go mean, and this story does go mean. But you know, I think it's a testament to how people react to the characters and how they're into it, where it's not they're not letting that have an excuse to turn away from the movie or to review bomb it or whatever the fuck, you know, the kids do these days for fun. So congrats, guys.
Thank you
so much.
That was cool. So great talking to you. Gosh,
yeah, totally. You too.
You're a wealth of knowledge. I just want to go and dive in, and I'm going to go read Joyland and watch this the series.
We'll come back and join us again for another show.
Oh, I'd love to.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, you guys are always welcome back. You can do homework. You can read Joyland. You can read Revival. That's another one that I love.
Okay, I'm making a list. Okay, yeah. Joyland, Revival.
Revival, Mike Flanagan wrote a screenplay and almost adapted it into a feature, and then it got shut down. And you talk about, you know, I talked about how King is a humanist and like an optimistic guy. Revival is one of his stories where that guy kind of goes out the window and it becomes way more of a downer story. So,
okay.
Killer ending I'll tell you that much.
I'm going to go give it a read.
Hell
got my homework.
Yeah, do your homework, come back, and you can talk about the joyfulness of Joyland, and then the, oh God, existential horror, how am I going to live my life after finishing Revival? Yeah, that's your task. Read two books and come back to us.
All right.
Got it, guys. Well, I'm on it.
Good talking to you.
Awesome, guys.
Thank you so much.
Congrats on the movie, and everybody go see Obsession in a theater near you. Many thanks to Michael and Cooper for joining us for this chat. Obsession is proving to be a giant hit so far. Won the last weekend. So if you haven't seen it yet, give it a chance. Go check it out at your earliest convenience at a theater near you. You're going to dig it. The movie rules. And speaking of things that rule, our next guest absolutely fucking rules. He is one of the stars of what I consider to be the coolest ongoing show out there right now, at least one that feels specifically made just for little old me. It's called Widow's Bay. It's on Apple TV, and if you dig the KingCast, you're going to love the show. It's basically like if Stephen King's Castle Rock had a baby with Amity from Jaws, right? It's got that great Northeastern spooky vibes to it. It is so, so good. I don't want to spoil anything. Go watch it. I was going to be kind of coy, actually, when I was talking about the guest. I usually like to do that when we haven't recorded with somebody yet, but we've already recorded with this person, so fuck it. I'm just going to go ahead and announce it is the great character actor Stephen Root is joining us. He was the next guest on the KingCast. In Widow's Bay, he's the Quint-like character, but you've seen this dude in a trillion things, like Milton in Office Space or in Barry. He always rules. He's one of those guys that my friends and I like to call never bads. He's never bad in anything he's in. He can be in bad things. He is never bad in bad things. You know what I mean? He is one of those people. I was so excited to get him on the show. Turns out his favorite King thing was 11-22-63, so we focus on that quite a bit. So now you're prepared. This episode will run in a couple of weeks, just around the season finale of Widow's Bay, I believe. So catch up on that if you're behind, and look forward to it. It's a really fun chat. In the meantime, why don't you sign up for our Patreon? You will get access to hundreds of bonus episodes, ranging from special interviews, commentary tracks, our own actual play D&D adventure series, mailbags, you name it. It's the single best way to support the show, so sign up over at patreon.com/thekingcast. You're going to have a bevy of goodies waiting for you over there, I swear. All right, that should do it. See you in a couple weeks with a great Stephen Root. Adios, folks. The KingCast is hosted by Eric Vespi, that's me, and Anthony Bresnikan. The show is produced by myself as well as Abby Goel and Tara Ansley, and is distributed by the Fangoria Podcast Network. Daniel Danger is our art director, and the show was created by me, the late, great Scott Wampler.